Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast. In this segment, we'll be interviewing Mr. J.R. Maycock. He is the CIO of Perpetual Storage. J.R., thanks for your time this afternoon, and welcome to our show.
Glad to be here, Robbie.
Thanks. J.R., tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in security or cybersecurity in general, and tell us any highlights of your career, please.
Absolutely. So I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I've always been interested in tech from even a really young age. I probably got into this in the same way that a lot of my compatriots in the technical administration space did, and that's as a video gamer. Along the way, I tried to convert that to something a little more professional, and I've been exposed over time. I've had the good fortune to be exposed to a lot of different environments. My first non-freelance IT work was actually in higher education when I was in university. So computer lab work and network control systems there. For a few years, about 7 or 8, beginning in 2010, I moved into a systems administration realm. And I worked in the section of the industry for logistics and transportation and warehousing for a corporate entity privately owned that went through a very large growth cycle. My time there spanned from, at the start, a headcount of about 150 people, and at the end, a headcount of about 1,000 people. So got to watch a lot of the frontline transformations of IT systems of this last decade, and take a company from a place that was a smaller operating and lower maturity level into a much higher operational maturity level and a much more sophisticated interaction with cybersecurity threats just based on that growth in size and that growth in attractiveness. For the last few years, I've been working in the service provider space, either as a technical architect or now directly as an employee of Perpetual Storage and being the head of their technology department. In this space, I think that's where I've really gained the most appreciation for the diversity of security threats that people really are facing. Seeing 80, 90 plus client environments up close in different kinds of closely regulated industries, financial, healthcare, and cutting edge manufacturing, high patent sensitivity places, I've started to be able to really see what is required to grapple with the topic of data protection and the modern environment a lot better. So, yeah, I certainly come from a decently diversified technical background, strong emphasis on system administration, and then equally strong emphasis on user behavior security and looking at how human action elements interact with technical elements, because neither side can stand alone.
Okay, excellent. Now, your bio suggests that you have a deep background in like systems management and behavioral security. What is the difference between the two? Could you please elaborate that on that for us, and how did it impact your career?
Yeah. Systems management is direct interaction with the core technical infrastructure. So this is touching things that understand ones and zeros and are built out of silicon, either storage infrastructure or network hardware or applications and software, but all fundamentally digital technology without a personality. Behavioral security is how do human beings end up interacting and using those systems, bringing in the element of what does it mean to have people touch data. And that invokes a lot more emphasis on human psychology and the ability to use social engineering tactics to overcome even the most elegantly designed technical security infrastructure. And both of those really need to be understood in concert with one another. Computer systems have no intrinsic use unless people can derive meaning and value from them, being able to do business with them. And just the same, people shouldn't be treated like computer systems. You can't just automatically assume that rote rules or core instructions are going to be appropriate for interacting with human beings. So, yeah, I've had to certainly learn how to treat those two realms with their appropriate degree of differentiation, but also understand that the overlap of those two, the core nexus between the two, is where high-functioning companies operate or where low-functioning companies face their greatest degree of cybersecurity risk.
Okay. Now, how do you engage with your current employer, Perpetual Storage? Is this a company you kind of helped create on your own, or are you just an employee, or how did that work out for you?
Yeah. My first engagement with them was actually as a customer of theirs and a tester of the cloud storage services that Perpetual Storage offers. This was beginning 5 years ago or so, and those service offerings were in their earliest beta stage. So I've had the opportunity to begin influencing what type of offerings Perpetual Storage is going to use, even just by good luck from those earliest times. Then since those earliest testing days, I've had the role of being a technical architect and designing much of the back-end service provider infrastructure for the storage services that we run under the brand called Granite Cloud. And I've been a direct hire employee for approaching a year now, beyond those technical architect offerings for a couple years before that. So I certainly feel like I have very good visibility into what our core product offerings have been in the last 5 years, just by first coming in from the outside and seeing it from the customer perspective, and then eventually inside for core responsibility and that direct hire role.
Okay, now how long has PSI been in business, and what makes them unique as a company? So really, tell us what your line of business is. Why should a customer come to you first versus your competition? There are kind of two separate questions in there, but if you could answer both, that'd be great.
That I can do. Perpetual Storage is actually a fairly old company, got a nice strong legacy. It first opened its doors in 1968, and it has been owned by the same family the entire time, operating now through 2020. The second and third generation members of that family are now the owners and operators compared to the folks from 1968. The core line of business is asset protection, and that began with what our most unique facet is as well. That's the actual physical campus that Perpetual Storage operates at. In Little Cottonwood Canyon, to the east of Salt Lake City, Utah, is where our campus is built. And how we operate is as an underground vault that was carved out going a few hundred feet back into a very unique rock formation. There's only five or six formations like this one on the planet, and this is the only one that has ever been commercially exploited. It's a huge homogeneous piece of granite rock that has characteristics of seismic stability and water stability, the way that groundwater ever flows through it, that are incredibly stable over huge, long-term, multi-million-year geologic timescales. The campus itself is a vault carved back in for about three stories tall vertically and multiple hundred feet horizontally of storage space. So for the operating decades beginning in the 1960s through the 1990s, that meant that the physical storage was of critical company documents, of microfilm, and of things like precious metals. As we've evolved forward over time, more and more of those critical company assets became digitized instead of physical. So today, Perpetual Storage's physical operations are centered on the transport of digital media, say magnetic tape, or hard drives, or full-scale storage systems, hardware security modules, root encryption keys, that sort of stuff. Then we also run a data center where we provide a private cloud location for off-site data storage services that are then able to take advantage of our really extremely unique physical campus. What I think makes us the most unique, though, and this is that second question about why a client organization would want to choose us over any other competitor. First, we have near total immunity from natural disasters, man-made disasters. The shape of the vault is even designed to withstand fairly direct nuclear blasts, let alone anything that's simply tornado, earthquake, flood, that kind of thing. So the degree of protection we offer against the destruction of that data in the physical sense is unique. More importantly, though, is with nearly 50 years of operating time going on here, or just over 50 years of operating time, perpetual storage has organizational discipline and deep experience with the nuts and bolts of what it means to be a high security provider. We understand how to very carefully vet and authorize all requests coming in for any changes to data sets. We are resistant to the types of social engineering techniques that can really trip up other competitors in this space and grant unauthorized access to data in a way that simply because they don't have that maturity of operating history with those nuts and bolts of security practices, they are vulnerable to, and we really aren't. That's, I think, one of our most distinctive features beyond the campus itself, is that depth of experience and that precision of ingrained behavior and culture inside the company to really understand what it means to be a security provider.
Okay. Now, it seems like PSI is more focused on the physical storage, as you said, like tape backups and other sorts of media. Now, how has business been given this current situation that we're in right now, or that the world is in? And do you face some stiff competition from the likes of Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure with their cloud backup storage services?
Well, those services certainly are top of mind to all clients in the world, including ours. They are not anything of a direct competitor because it's a fairly direct, it's fairly apples to oranges comparison for the ultimate capabilities of storage. For instance, if you're going to store physical storage media, there's no way to send it to those companies. But more likely, what you want to do as a client organization is maybe ramp down your use of physical storage media and ramp up your equivalent consuming the outcome of offsite storage via sending data across network clients, putting it into a cloud storage target. Cloud to me just meaning other people's computers in some form. So we offer at Perpetual Storage this Granite Cloud brand of cloud storage services. And what demarcates us as different is a couple things. We have really special focus on giving the best quality offsite storage location that you can consume compared to a competitor or this alternative organization like Azure or AWS. That's not their focus alone. They are able to provide all sorts of infrastructure services, platform services. There are several hundred offerings under each of their catalogs of significant maturity and amazement, some very good products there, but they certainly don't focus, therefore, on making storage offerings as high quality as possible. The other thing is, all of their offerings will always be online and network accessible. The maximum degree of security that an administrator can possibly configure cannot overcome that those are public cloud endpoints kept online and available 100% of the time, and a successfully sophisticated cybersecurity breach would be able to take over, destroy, damage, or lock out all of the data stored in those locations. What PSI offers that is particularly unique is storage you could consume in a cloud-like fashion, meaning you can transit the data backwards and forwards from using a computer network, using the internet, but the actual storage media, once the data arrives and is held on your behalf, is offline and physically air-gapped. No software mechanisms, actual, real, deep air-gapping. So that's why I tend to think of it as a significant apples to oranges discussion there. The utility of public cloud services like Azure and AWS absolutely exists for companies. The utility of services that we provide is to do something that they don't or can't beyond just the basic sending ones and zeros of storage.
Gotcha. Never really thought of things in that perspective. I'm kind of more of a cloud guy. Never really think the most I have for a physical security backup is my thumb drive. I've got everything backed up in the cloud. So that's definitely a very interesting perspective. Now, even before COVID-19 hit, the concept of data protection, data backup, data recovery, so forth, has always been around in the realms of both security and cybersecurity. Now, to many professionals, to many people, that may mean many different things. But from your standpoint and being a professional in this field, what can you unpack or kind of expand further on what does this term mean for our audience? You know, they may not necessarily be like an IT manager or so forth. It just might be the average American citizen. Can you elaborate more on that, please?
Absolutely. And yeah, understanding of this term, data protection, is just as important for every business stakeholder, regardless of their relationship to technical infrastructure. Data protection, in my mind, refers to a series of technical processes that are designed to maintain integrity of corporate assets that are stored in digital form, as well as confidentiality of those assets. So the integrity portion of this is measured by, can the data be proven to not have changed from a particular point in time? Can the data be brought back to older states if there is damage to newer states? And can the data be guaranteed in enough different states at once, different locations of storage, for instance, that a company is not vulnerable to the destruction of their highly valuable assets based on some physical emergency or digital emergency, a building falling down, a fire, a hack, a piece of ransomware? All of those concepts come together with the integrity portion of the description. Confidentiality portion, that's enforced by things like access control rules and making sure that the more sensitive data is, the more sensitive the asset represented in that data, the fewer people have access, the more thorough the requirement for authentication and proving that the human making the request for access is who they say they are and that they are entitled to see that data, and then making sure that that data stays only in approved locations, that it is not leaked or moved to other locations where the confidentiality rating of the data goes down, that more people can see it who shouldn't see it. All of those concepts wrapped up together form what anyone in a business stakeholder position should understand as the definition of data protection.
Wow, excellent. Now, at a more higher level, macro level, one of the main forces that are making data protection more complex as we enter into this new decade, you know, the 2020s, and has the coronavirus pandemic kind of impacted the complexity even more, do you think?
Oh, very much so. Coronavirus and the current lockdown of the world, the explosion of remote work, has exacerbated some of the gaps in data protection that are very common in operating companies. I guess the missing parts have come into sharp relief explicitly because of the way that coronavirus and our associated social distancing changes have impacted the work environment. I think that my answer to this question around, you know, what are those top-level forces, really lines up with the even larger version of this, which is what are the top-level forces driving the quote-unquote digital transformation of business here in the late 2010s, early 2020s. I think that it probably boils down to a few core things, one of them being the mobility of data, and that there is now a user expectation as well as a customer expectation of immediacy in being able to get to any data or any application or service, and from being able to do that anywhere, that there is no longer the concept of a network perimeter around a physical office space, and that things happen there in that one place and are not available outside, or that requests are able to be just sent and then serviced much later, some days or weeks later, as opposed to data being available right now. That whole constellation of stuff that started with delivering applications in software as a service form and mobile technology like smartphones getting completely ubiquitous to now where we all carry these computers in our pockets 100% of the time, that changed our fundamental landscape of expectations for what it meant to interact with data and technical systems. Then another high-level force that's going on here is the shift from traditional infrastructure that was purchased by companies located at their business sites or co-location facilities and involved objects that usually looked like server racks and had servers and network components and storage components owned by a corporate entity. And that's shifting now to be this multi-cloud infrastructure instead, where different portions of the technical infrastructure of a business will be assigned to different locations and providers based on aptitude. One company, even if they're a fairly small company, let's say under 100 employee headcount, it's perfectly reasonable in the calendar year 2020 for that company to choose to put portions of their business operations into Amazon Web Services, other portions into Microsoft Azure, other portions into consuming software as a service products, specialized delivery of actual user-accessible applications directly from individual providers, and then they'll still own some minimal amount of computer hardware, you know, end-user workstations and a network infrastructure in their buildings, maybe some manner of servers or things that still look like they're in a server rack, and all of those pieces together are being chosen to try and get at the best combination of efficiency and lowering the total amount of native IT staff and native knowledge that have to be direct hired, and spreading around how to have access to the best types of products and the best outcome experiences by using all those multiple cloud pieces. The other thing that's really influencing it is cybersecurity adversaries are getting much, much more sophisticated in the last few years. I know that probably to every listener, regardless of whether they're inside or outside of a technical field, I'm going to sound like I'm beating a dead horse on this. This is something that is so constantly in the news about how all the nature of cybersecurity threats and the degree of their sophistication is going up, but some false advertising or some decision among business leaders to try and drum up scare tactics for the public. It really is happening. The growth of ransomware, the growth of highly targeted persistent malware, and the degree of money to be made by people who have a high degree of technical skill and want to use it for unethical means, those are all driving significant risk towards businesses across all sectors and down in size beyond just, you know, giant multinational corporations that have traditionally been targets. It is all the way down even into the small business section now that really has to consider cybersecurity risk and what that means for their business operations as a significant continuous threat. Those are all the like larger context informing why data protection matters more now in 2020 and this upcoming decade than it did in the last 10 years.
Well, you know, why should corporate America, you know, SMBs, Fortune 500, what have you, why should they care about this topic? And what kind of risks are they being exposed to by not having good data protection controls or policies in place?
I'd certainly call the risks existential in nature. They are often ignored or downplayed. And sometimes that's out of a just innocent ignorance of some of the degree of risk involved, or sometimes it's out of a fear of what the cost of addressing the risk could be. But giving into that kind of fear or ignoring these risks is one of the worst situations that anyone in corporate America could get themselves into. That's a case of digging your own grave unnecessarily. So if I were to try and represent in some just concrete, specific, and emotionally unloaded language, just very practical terms, what these risks really are, they'd fall into a few places. The first of them is operations disruption. The sense that if you have an event that takes place that damages your data and makes it so that it isn't there in the way you normally need it to be there, you're going to have employees unable to do their job. And almost no company can be immune to this. Even companies, so all those years that I spent in logistics and transportation, that's a very physical space. Everything is happening in warehouses, pallets, trucks, boxes, but none of that can ever be moved or transited unless it has an identical digital representation. The digital is being tracked as the source of truth, even for all of these objects in the physical realm, meaning the ability of any company to have day-to-day operations and to be able to have employee productivity depends on data being accessible and intact. Another big risk that companies will face here is intellectual property loss, the theft of secrets, of competitive advantage that is unique to them that can be taken away because it is represented in digital form and then can be given to other competitors or held ransom against them or just destroyed in certain cases, you know, rendered inaccessible, and then it has to be recreated. And all the time invested to create that knowledge, to create that specialty, has to be reinvested, which carries very significant cost, and then the loss of competitive advantage in the market because you can't get that product or that service to market nearly as quickly as you would have hoped. The other very big one that should resonate with absolutely everyone is the loss of reputation trust with customers. If a company ends up in the worst case in major regional or national news describing a cybersecurity event about them, that is some of the most negative press that can happen and involves a very direct effect to company revenue. Customers go away, long-term contracts get canceled, and you have to fight so hard to re-earn that credibility that it just acts as a drag, a heavy anchor against the effectiveness of your sales force and maintaining good relationships with existing clients and customers over time. That also then can extend into the realm of liability and litigation. There are specific statutes in the world, particularly having to do with consumer data and privacy protection, the most famous examples being from the European Union, the GDPR, and from California, the new data privacy regulations for consumers from the last roughly 2 years that have gone out of draft form and entered full form now. Customer data as well as partner data have regulatory and compliance regimes around them. They contain enforcement mechanisms and create exposure to litigation risk for a company, either from external private individuals or in contract law from your business partners, from supply chain individuals who either depend on you or who you depend on, who contain clauses in almost all of your existing contracts about certain fundamental data security standards or anything else. If there is an event because your data protection policy is incomplete and you end up in a cybersecurity threat risk, then these risks can all compound on you and you can end up facing the loss of access to partners and supply chains just as much as you can end up facing the loss of customer trust and possible exposure to litigation, exposure to financial cost from long-term lawsuits and that kind of thing.
Okay, excellent. Now, when and where should companies tackle this topic of trying to protect their data? To me, I think it should have been done yesterday, but you know, with what's been going on, I think companies are now starting to realize, ooh, I should have done this. And now they're starting to wake up and smell the coffee. Let's start doing something now. So in your opinion, where in the process should companies be addressing this issue?
Yeah. So step one is to recognize that this is going to be a cross-department discipline, that it's going to involve the collaboration between really multiple different sectors of the business, not just technical assets and not just business leadership access, but also finance and operations, and is going to need to have some significant collaboration between all of the minds of the people responsible for those areas of the business. And I've definitely encouraged people to stay calm, don't panic, and come at this with a real level head. And the very first place a company should go, step one every time, should be to create a baseline data policy. These are documents, effectively, declarative statements that guide what are the minimum mandatory operating rules for a company vis-a-vis data protection. And I think that it ultimately means, if nothing else, you're going to need two slightly overlapping and interconnected policy documents to form your baseline. One of them is a policy that is explicitly called data protection, and that it addresses the elements that we have described around data integrity, data confidentiality, who can access data, when, why, and how does it need to be kept protected. The other document needs to be some kind of a disaster recovery policy. It needs to describe where is data stored in backup form, how can that backup be enacted, and how durations relate to or change with the use of those backup systems if they have to be invoked. Those are the core policy areas that need to be represented. And by starting with getting those documents in textual form, it removes a huge degree of ambiguity and guides future technical and future business process implementation steps in terms of getting to a high maturity operating state for data protection.
Okay, excellent. Now let's move our topic to look at the technical implementations that's required to keep corporate data safe. Can you give us a summary for our audience what the most important actions that both IT and business stakeholders can enact or invoke?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this is where we're going to really start drilling into that data integrity section from the larger conceptual pool of data protection. This is just a few little bullet points real quick that, you know, maybe we can dive into specific ones later on. But in real short summary form, they need to account for all of the sources of production data that hold anything of value to the company, wherever they are stored, documents, databases, websites, archives, all of it. And as noted when we were talking about part of the larger shifts in IT, is those are now stored potentially across multiple cloud providers, software as a service providers, on-site storage, people's workstations. You need to cast a wide net in making sure you get every system accounted for and bringing it all together and not leaving yourself with gaps in your understanding. Then you absolutely have to create separate administrative realms for the production data systems that are used day-to-day in productivity tasks and the disaster recovery systems that are responsible for storing backup copies, enacting pieces of your data protection policy, and getting the actual technical work of additional instances of data, getting that done. Then, no matter what, everything that your company touches, that your company directly owns and controls. This is especially important vis-a-vis software as a service applications. So, for instance, Salesforce is an extremely common software as a service application for CRM and enterprise resource planning workflows. All of the data that you are storing in Salesforce servers in your tenant, you must schedule an output job to get one instance of it every so often back down as some kind of an archive file onto a system you own. Don't let other software as a service providers own all of your data with no instances of it ever under your control. That's an unacceptable degree of risk. Final thing that's very important for any company to consider is about simple geography. That if your company happens to have only one office and operates in a specific place, don't allow every copy of your data to permanently reside within that simple geographic area, you know, your office or within 10 or 50 miles of it, and be exposed to the types of risks of natural disasters that can affect a whole area. Think about how to diversify those storage locations in some form. And if you do happen to own multiple offices and operate multiple branches in places, keep in mind that that then creates a slightly higher threshold of complexity where you need to account for data unique to each of those locations and get it to other places as well intentionally from each of those additional branches. That can create sort of an increase in the number of permutations, you know, multiplicatively counting out, okay, here's all the locations we have data, which means they all then need to be stored in this additional places. And that then takes some practical consideration of saying, we must not make sure data resides by accident in only one geography. Those are some of those technical implementation elements that are going to really matter.
Okay, well, now, what do you mean? Let's do a deep dive. You kind of alluded to the separating administrative realms. At a practical level, what does this really require? What does it mean? So forth.
Yeah. This is actually going to be one of those concepts, I think, that business stakeholders may not be familiar with at all yet, nor, for that matter, will technical individuals have yet thought along these particular lines. So I hope that for anyone in the audience listening today, maybe this can open some eyes. Think of it like this. Every computer system in existence either implicitly or explicitly belongs to some kind of an administrative realm. That administrative realm provides a source of truth for critical facets of how the computer system needs to operate. For instance, the user identities for who can log into the computer systems and how human beings get digitally represented as accounts, and the security policies, the rules that dictate what can a logged in user do? What can they access? What can they change? What can they see? All of those technical implementation elements belong to that can be common across a large number of systems at once. And that means that there is every system will interact in some way with an administrative realm controlling some of those rules. So at a practical level, when I say create separate ones, it means don't ever use the same user directory, security policies, other administrative control facets for your disaster recovery systems as you do for your production workstations, production software, production servers. It doesn't matter in reality what this identity system is. You know, there are lots of identity systems in use. There's a traditional one for on-premise infrastructure. The largest player there comes from Microsoft and is called Active Directory. There are lots of cloud identity systems for Amazon, for Google, for Microsoft in Office 365. And then there are local identities, accounts that only exist on one computer at a time. The logic is precisely the same in every one of those instances. The same identities that are in the day-to-day business execution productivity realm be used in the disaster recovery realm. And the reason to insist on this highly strict separation is because day-to-day productivity identities are the ones that are exposed to the greatest degree of risk of compromise through things like phishing of credentials, tricking a user to enter their username and password somewhere where it can be stolen, or keylogger software, malware inserted onto someone's computer that looks at the way keystrokes are typed, or the installation of malware onto a computer to take over and hijack that system, and then be able to use the identities embedded in that computer, actively used on that computer, to search around inside of a company. Since those productivity identities, those productivity systems are the ones that are exposed to the most constant risk, they need to be incapable of damaging disaster recovery systems, even if they are taken over. That's the fundamental requirement to drive separate administrative realms.
Okay. Now, you seem to be placing a large amount of emphasis on, you know, on security of user identities or identity, I guess, access management. Why is this the case? What mechanisms should companies use to meet this challenge? Are we talking more like cloud-based solutions or like more like physical security, like smart cards, fobs, etc.?
Any of those can actually be perfectly appropriate tools depending on the level of security that a company requires for its operations. You know, that's part of the beauty of declaring a baseline data policy is you'll largely have made that choice accurately earlier on by understanding the fundamental level of requirement your company faces. So user identities have become just about the most important part of a company's security perimeter. They are the gatekeepers now for everything in a much more meaningful way than physical locations or network security tools were in the past. Not to say that those tools don't matter still. Defense in depth is very much a real concept, and you should not cease using other tools. But user identities definitely matter. So if I were going to tell a company, here are some of the, you know, table stakes, fundamental ways to meet this challenge that everyone should use today, no matter what. Multi-factor authentication is definitely very, very high on the list. Do not let a username and a password be enough to authenticate to a system. Turn on some additional requirement of maybe a time-based one-time code to be entered, or a security key, or a push notification to an authenticator app on a smartphone device, or a phone call. Please avoid text messaging. That's too easily spoofed. Phone calls should come to controlled office phone numbers if used. But using multi-factor authentication everywhere, all of the time, for all access to systems is one of those most important ways to make it so you defeat that if some external actor is able to just grab a password, that's not good enough. Another thing is, dedicate your admin accounts as for any administrator level function, whether that is a technical person who has global administrator use or a delegated individual at the head of a department like finance or operations who has specific ability to change functions, not global administrator roles. Don't ever assign those to the same accounts that are doing productivity work. This isn't saying you need separate administrative realms for production systems per se. This is just saying inside production systems, have a separate username that does admin functions than the one that does productivity functions. Then make sure you have an audit log of how accounts are used and set up selective triggered alerts, things that go to you in email or instant message form or something, if there is an unusual use of a high power administrative account. You know, get an alert in as close to real time as you can manage if there is some kind of a compromise or abnormal behavior of one of these user identities that have a lot of power. And that's fundamentally why I want to place so much emphasis on user identities, because power to get to data and look at it in just standard user form, and then more dangerously to get to systems that house data and change them in administrative user form.
Okay. Just a side question here, JR. Now, when you talk about like the physical user identity, I started my career in security doing work in biometrics. Does your company Perpetual Storage, do you make use of biometric security, like the hand geometry scanners, fingerprint scanners, or iris scanners?
We do use certain pieces of those technology. In particular, the ones that we've been having the most trust in happen to deal with facial recognition mapping based on infrared cameras and depth sensing, something to overcome, you know, just being able to flash a picture up. All biometric security is not, I would say, a panacea. It's not an end-all be-all. It's not acceptable by itself, but it forms an extremely robust additional authentication factor or path in parallel with traditional use of things like passwords. Basically, biometrics should be layered with other types of security features, such as passwords. They should never act as the sole replacement for those features. That also extends down to things like physical use of security objects, you know, traditional keys and locks. If you can designate access to high security areas of your business through the possession of both a physical key and then a biometric scan, that is a significantly more intelligent choice than relying on just one or the other.
Okay. Now, offline backups are the next critical action item that you mentioned. Now, could you elaborate more on the 3-2-1 rule, and is this a rule that you are currently advocating?
Yeah. So 3-2-1 rule is a real old classic. I don't know. It's probably around from before I was ever in IT, but I've heard about it the entire time of my 14 or 15 years in the industry so far. For anyone unfamiliar with it, the classic form of that rule is keep 3 copies of your data on 2 separate types of media with at least one of those copies being housed off-site, somewhere that is not your office. I think that this rule does have significant value as an intellectual guide, but I actually think it needs to be updated for what the criteria of most of those pieces of 3, 2, and 1 are referring to. Basically, this is an adaptation that I think fits in with all the discussion we had a few minutes ago around what are the large picture changes in how technical systems are being used and what types of data protection actions are necessary to deal with the challenges of the upcoming decade of the 2020s. So if I were going to restate what this rule needs to be in more modern times, it would be that 3 copies of the data still need to exist. That portion really doesn't change that much. However, they need to be inside 2 separate administrative domains, administrative realms, instead of considering the 2 separate media types. And then the most important change is to the one section. At least one copy of the data must be in a location that is not accessible from any production corporate network. Offline, offsite data is really the holy grail of your data protection strategy when it comes to data integrity. Being able to know for certain that there was an instance of the data state for your company's assets captured accurately and then put somewhere where there is no possible path to damage that data, no matter the scope or degree of the compromise of your cybersecurity environment, of your production network, means you can be certain about your ability to recover even from maximum severity events. That's why I think that there should be new emphasis on offline backups in this upcoming decade. The nature of the cybersecurity threats and the way they operate against network-connected, accessible targets means offline storage has suddenly become the real only mechanism to safety. Absent that offline storage being available, I'm not sure almost any company could consider their data protection strategy complete.
Okay, now another term here is air gaps. Now, I think that's a term that's now kind of being bandied about here, as, you know, as we talk from a cyber perspective, you know, of taxi critical infrastructure, we hear about legacy systems being air gapped. But what do you mean by physical air gap? And why should corporate stakeholders care about what would potentially seem to be overly technical items or minutiae, as you would say?
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those air gap gets tossed around as I guess I'd call it a TV show plot term, right? This is from police procedurals or military hacking dramas and air gaps and throwing the switches and cutting the lines and that kind of thing. Well, it's not quite that exciting and sexy in the real world. An air gap system is one that does not have a network-based access path towards its execution environment. So when legacy running data systems are air-gapped, it means they execute in privately secured, totally isolated running environments where they are allowed to do their jobs and mess with their local data states, but there's no outbound access into them from some external network location. When I'm in this interview or when my company, Perpetual Storage, is using the term physical air gap, we're really referring to the way that data states can be stored offline, not really so much the execution of computer systems in an air-gapped hosted environment, much more instead around when data is stored, it needs to be physically air-gapped, not some electronic or software-based substitute mechanism. The actual storage media needs to be isolated and inaccessible so that no commands sent across a network, even in the disaster recovery administrative realm, and even to the systems that took those backups in the first place, are able to touch or modify that data set. And this is really one of those cases where a lot of market providers have started to muddy the waters by describing software-based mechanisms for file locking or software-based mechanisms to reduce the number of users who have permissions to access data as equivalent to air gapping or offline backups. And I am really not a fan of using those terms inappropriately. I find it to be an inappropriate use in the advertising materials of multiple cloud storage providers and backup vendors when they are describing software-based mechanisms as air-gapped or offline, when in reality they aren't. I think that customers should hold those vendors to a higher standard and insist on a real documented proof that when a backup set of data is being kept in protected offline state, it is physically air-gapped, there is no network-based path, end of story. Corporate stakeholders really do need to care about that because it's the only way to guarantee safety, as we noted. This is one of those questions that every business stakeholder should be asking of the implementation team in charge of either vetting vendors who are going to provide those products or enacting it for a business. This is something that any business leader should be directly caring about and should not leave to be unquestioned. Even though it is a highly technical detail, this is one that really matters. This is one of those very few distinctions that is the difference in between incomplete data protection, not achieving actual safety, and real safety, real guarantees that your company's data can come back from an emergency regardless of the severity of that emergency in the first place.
Okay. Now, suppose company XYZ puts all their production data all into, physical storage, mediums like whether it's vault, USB drive, what have you. Is that going to be good enough to stay protected? To me, it's not, because I think production data means it's a much broader, more encompassing term. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm going to stumble over this sentence because it has too many M's. It is a minimum mandatory first step. You can't get to protection without taking that action, making sure you've got holistic backups covering everything. But backups alone aren't a cohesive and successful data protection strategy. You need to be able to restore the backups. This is another place where the pressure from different vendors and how they advertise into the marketplace emphasizes very loudly backup capabilities and then often just sort of implicitly whimpers about restore abilities. It's not talked about that often because it's the more difficult data protection goal to achieve. If your company does not have a validated way to restore data states and to align your company operations to when those data states are restored and how the company needs to operate during the restore workflows, after the restore workflows are complete, then you're not going to be able to actually stay protected in certain kinds of cybersecurity events or disaster events. It's not enough just to have backup itself. Everything hinges on the restore of those backups and the return to company operations, company productivity.
Okay. Now, what are the hidden pitfalls in recovering data? Suppose, company XYZ has been impacted like by a tornado, hurricane, what have you, or even by large-scale cyber attack. What are the risks, and why are these risks not talked about more often? I just wrote a big white paper for a client just yesterday, actually, in business continuity planning, and a big chunk about that was part of that plan needs to include the step-by-step procedures of how you're going to get your data back up and running. So could you please elaborate more on that?
Yeah, happily. Well, what place? I was about to try and say the most important pitfall is blank, but that's probably an arbitrary assignment of importance. Why don't we say there's a couple that are equally important. One pitfall is having a hypothetical plan that you've never tested in action. No declared plan ever survives contact with reality and, needs some modification along the way. So actually execute it before an emergency strikes your company and make sure you iron out those wrinkles is a really important piece of this as a hidden pitfall. If you can write the most elegant plan for how recovery needs to take place, but you need to test it, then actually validating your backup states is another one. Don't just write backups and assume they are valid, intact, and have the correct data. Test them. Test their restores, test their integrity, and test them over time on systems that they're stored on. Don't, you know, accept that, sure, everything was clean when it was written once, 5 weeks ago, 6 months ago, whatever point in time it happens to be, and then don't recheck it in the future. Don't just let the data sit there stale on the assumption that it will be happy and intact when you go to need it. Also, there are hidden dependencies in how companies need to use their data. Sometimes two systems that don't seem to have a lot in common actually are both required for a user to get their job done. Make sure that when you've designed this recovery plan, you've talked to people and you've sat with them and learned how they do their real-world work across hours and days of time to see that maybe someone who needs customer information from System A also needs email at the exact same time. If they didn't have both of those systems alive at once, they wouldn't be able to process some workflow like orders or reporting. Those two systems may not seem to have any technical dependencies, if abstract, but because the human workflows with those systems, the way that actual people do work at your company requires them to be simultaneously alive, you need to understand that those systems are now connected in your disaster recovery plan, that the availability of both of them is required before user productivity can return. So that's another hidden pitfall, is hyper-focus on the technical layer and ignoring the actual human operations layer will put you in a place where your recovery is going to take a lot longer or may fail entirely in a way that you didn't expect it to. I don't know exactly how to speculate on why these risks aren't talked about more often. I would imagine that because there's not as easy of a revenue opportunity for certain vendors who just want to sell software or to sell storage services or that kind of stuff, then there's not as much market discussion of why these processes matter. Maybe it's because this is the stuff that really decides the effectiveness of businesses and not a easy sales pitch opportunity. That may be a bit of a negative interpretation, but that does seem to be a bit of my exposure experience there. It may also be because these are more detailed facets that take a little bit more time investment internally with a company to grapple with, to get specific knowledge of how are people doing work and how do human systems relate to technical ones. And what do you think, Robbie, on this topic? Why are these risks not talked about as often as they should be? In writing your white papers, what have you come up with?
Well, I just think that companies are just naive. You know, they just, from what I've seen, I'm not like a technical expert, you know, like getting a deep dive of the cyber stuff. You know, I'm more of a content generator. But I think a lot of these companies, they just don't take the time to really understand what they're doing. Unfortunately, I think the biggest risk factor is we just live in a very naive and a very reactive society. Because we don't do anything until something really bad happens, like 9/11. I hate to kind of, you know, use that subject line, but, you know, I think back then, I think, you know, the CIA and whoever, you know, they had intelligence that something bad was going to happen, and they did have intel on these terrorists that were, you know, were at these flight academies, but nothing was really being done about it. And the same thing with these cyber attacks. I mean, companies just don't really seem to get it because their mentality is, well, if it hasn't happened to me, it's never going to happen. Well, guess what? The moment you take that kind of thinking, it's going to happen probably very, very soon or at some point in time for you. And I just think that companies just, they just don't really seem to get it. And I just don't seem to understand that. It's just, I think, you know, and especially in corporate America, you know, the C-levels, their hands are tied. People just don't even, they still don't even want to talk about it. Yeah, I bet you talk to maybe 8 out of 10 companies, they probably don't even have a data backup recovery in place, or even if you ask the CIO or the CISO, they probably don't even know what's going on. It's just, it's, that we live in just a very reactive society. And that's a more of a macro level answer. But that's what I'm thinking. I mean, that's what I write about, and that's, you know, what I come across in news headlines every day. It's just that people just don't want to take that extra time. And I just think, I don't know if it's laziness or just that mentality, well, it's never going to, you know, I'm never going to be impacted, so why bother? But you know what? Guess what? I mean, if you're impacted, there is a lot to lose if you don't have your data backed up. And as you mentioned about this before, there's going to be, you know, you're going to have downtime, there's going to be financial loss, and then more importantly, you're going to have a very tarnished brand reputation, brand image, and you're going to lose customers. You know, I just did another piece somewhere. I remember I did a blog or a small article for another client on just how customers will not come back to a company if they've been impacted by a cyber breach. And that's understandable. In fact, I think it was a blog I wrote maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago. And I think it was a cyber company that did this survey. And I'll wager, I think if I remember correctly, 40-50% of those survey. Now, this was just a general survey, not a lot of scientific study, you know, not a lot of scientific permutations were revealed in the study, but on the general level, I think 40-50% of those respondents would not go back to the same company if they were hit, if that company was hit by a cyber attack in which their PII was compromised. And that's, I would never want that either, but, you know, I mean, it's just, I wish, you know, companies would just understand that this is a serious thing. And you know, you may lose customers, but your image that you've worked so hard for to build up, it's going to be gone in just a matter of seconds. You know, so why not just take that extra step, talk to provider and get that data backed up? I mean, how long can it take, right? Or if you're lazy to do that, get something on Dropbox or get something on Azure or AWS and just get something set up quickly that way until you have a more perfect plan in place. And in fact, I think data backup recovery should be a very integral component of any incident response plan, disaster recovery plan, and the business continuity plan. It needs to be addressed in all three, especially the security policies, because, you know, we all are at risk, and what are you going to do if you can't restore that data? You know, it's just, you're gone, right?
It's a sobering thought, for sure.
Right. I can try to find a blog for, I know I've written, because I know that it's coming right across my mind, but I just can't remember when I wrote it. It was recently. I'll try to backtrack that blog for you, JR, and try to share it with you. But that's more from coming from a psychological perspective. I just think that I just don't think people really care until they're impacted. And once they're impacted, they still probably don't even care. You know, they have that wake up. They get like the big coffee jolt, you know, like, ooh, something's bad happened to me. I better recover. But if they have that done, then they probably just forget about it and move on. I just think really it's the kind of, now I'm not knocking our society, I just think this our mentality in general, you know, that's just what I think. But anyway, so that kind of leads me to another grouping of questions which are kind of similar. Now, as much as I mentioned that corporate America is lazy in backing up their data, how much of that work should they take on for themselves? That's the next question I was going to ask you.
Yeah, indeed. So how do we figure out how to parcel it in a balanced way and make it so that someone who isn't easily motivated to action can get across that threshold and do something meaningful? How do we make it as easy as possible? Well, that's just, there's a couple things. There's no avoiding the responsibility in having the internal conversation of the business to understand where all the production data sits, and there's no avoiding the responsibility of having at least the minimum knowledge of how people really use those systems, talking to employees, looking at the real-world processes, not just the abstract idea of this system allows people to see customer records, so clearly when they go look at customer stuff, that's the one they use. You know, see it in action in the real world for what the real process is, not the abstract idea. Those are the unavoidable pieces of work that a company must have done internally. But from that point on, there's really an opportunity to involve partner organizations, service providers, specialists in this data protection space that can do a really thorough job and cut down the amount of time spent that a company has to experience in order to get to the outcome state of having high-functioning data protection. So the knowledge set has to be built inside of a company, and the identification of what the production systems are and how they're going to have at least some backups captured. That's the table stakes of what they need to do internally. From there, I think there's an opportunity to turn to service providers and build more optimal relationships.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'll be honest with you, I just recently, probably about a couple of months ago, I just got my AWS, Amazon Web Services, and Azure accounts. And I've been playing around, you know, whenever I get a few minutes about their storage features, and I can create, like, data backups and all that. And I think it's great. I think you can get stuff set up very quickly. But the next enigma for me to solve is how do you actually get that stuff uploaded, because I still think it's kind of a complicated process. And for me, I would prefer to have somebody else kind of do that for me. I mean, I can create the virtual machines, I can create the virtual backup, you know, meet the actual media, but to actually do that on a day-to-day basis, I'd rather have someone do that, kind of like perpetual storage. So this kind of leads me to the next question. Do you think people should just say, hey, you know, this is not my area of expertise, let me back off, let me partner up with someone like perpetual storage and have them do the stuff for me? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it is usually an intelligent play, certainly based on efficiency and expertise and that return to optimal expenditure of money. Budgeting for engaging a service provider and getting implementation assistance is significantly more effective than, in most cases, budgeting for internal training and dedication of time and staff. There is a selection of companies, especially in the very largest marketplace size, you know, 30,000 plus employees, where it simply makes more sense for them to control it all in-house. But that describes a very small number of the total percentage of businesses in America compared to those that can benefit from looking at a storage provider relationship. Now, certainly not all storage providers or service providers are made equal in this respect. There's a couple of steps of how to vet a provider that you really should go through. Your provider should be willing to customize and contextualize their offerings to the specific requirements of your business. Having someone who is going to be prescriptive and dictate to you a standardized model for data protection that does not incorporate any active listening or any feedback or flow of information from the specific context of your business operations would be inappropriate. That would be a red flag to me. The other is if the provider is going to simply lead with price alone and be like, let's chase it down to the bottom dollar and cost the minimum number of cents per day to get this goal done, that suggests that their attention to detail is going to be compromised and that their chase of that raw price alone is ignoring the correct picture of value of delivering appropriately priced services for significant real protection. I would be concerned if I were engaging with a provider that was only price focused and did not have any claims of actual services and value provided.
Okay, excellent. Now, let's kind of segue back to your company, Perpetual Storage. What kind of services do you offer for data protection? And I'm at your website as we've been having this podcast. And you also offer various different products like the digital media, the libraries, I think you call it Quantum. And then you have various storage cases. Can you just kind of give a high-level overview into all of these, please?
Absolutely. So the core lines of business that Perpetual Storage offers include the physical courier service and the storage of assets related to offline media that a company directly owns, tapes, drives, other storage media that they need held. That courier and delivery area is centralized into the Wasatch Front metropolitan area of Utah, but can interact through other types of commercial shipment services with other locations in the continental and larger United States, as well as Canada, Mexico, that kind of place, North American geography. That is a line of service that stretched back for the longest period of time for Perpetual Storage and represents, going all the way back to 1968, some of the core business we have done. then we are also a reseller and provider of certain pieces of backup hardware, including, as you mentioned, tape libraries from the Quantum line and media sets to go in some of those libraries. Though I will say our most important and relevant services that I would guess for the largest number of businesses who may be listeners today, or even just as a statement generally onto the market, has to do with our digital storage services that are offered under the brand name Granite Cloud. Granite Cloud is a storage service, an off-site and offline backup as a service offering, where a customer can subscribe to it. They are billed for storage utilization within our service provider infrastructure, and we serve as a location to be able to get backups that are captured of production systems sent over to a repository to be kept first in highly robust but network accessible, immediately accessible storage, and we advocate keeping several of the most recent copies of data there. Then we offer the ability to take instances, either some or all backups, out of that online accessible, network accessible storage in Granite Cloud and put it in an offline state. Our particular offering there is one that we call the isolated data tier, or the acronym that shortens it is IDT. So this is a managed service offering done entirely on the behalf of the customer that doesn't require their administrative team or their staff members to put in time, effort, execution to actually making it happen. A company declares via a data policy what backup states need to be captured in offline media and how long they need to be kept, and then Perpetual Storage executes the writing of those states, the storage of them in our specialized underground campus, and then any restore operations that need to take place for the customer. That's how we can help that customer get it done. I would say that really what demarcates us as unique in that piece of the question you asked is a couple of things. I alluded to our exclusive focus into this area, that it is our whole dedication as a business entity as opposed to being one among a large number of possible focus areas. We really care about making sure that we are doing the best imaginable job on this exact realm of data protection. We have an offline storage offering that is actually physically air-gapped. And as managed service offerings go, there really are very few or none, effectively none that we have found in the continental United States at all, that can replicate this feature set of getting data into a complete, physically air-gapped, securely stored offline state on your behalf without using customer staff resources to do it. And then I think what actually demarcates us potentially as the most unique of all is how we can help a customer recover. Almost every other storage provider in this space that is using a cloud-style connection topology, whether it is Amazon Web Services or Microsoft Azure or smaller storage providers like Offsite DataSync and iLand and focused competitors in those spaces, none of them generally have the ability to be able to get data back into a company environment in any rapid form. You are bottlenecked by whatever rate that they can upload data to the internet and you can download it. And often that's also got system throughput quotas that go beyond just what are the internet speed lines. It is completely normal for a company to be operating with a data set that is measured in many terabytes, terabytes being units of thousands of gigabytes at a time. A small company may only have 10 or 15 terabytes of data to protect, or even by the time you get into a mid-sized company, we're speaking to 200, 400 terabytes of data is the total company asset footprint. To get those resources back and restored to you from cloud providers that are internet gated, you will be waiting a time period of days to weeks. So 7, 8, 10 weeks is perfectly possible for how long you have to wait to get that data set back. We offer services that rely on writing the data set to portable storage devices and returning it to a customer environment in real time, or certainly within something like a 48-hour SLA, that then makes it all immediately accessible at once. I think that making sure a service provider has a useful story for restore timeline and vetting and testing the assumptions that they declare so that your disaster recovery plan and how long it says you have in order to get back online and save your company can be met by the technical infrastructure you choose is an extremely important part of this. Demarcating PSI as a unique offering, but independent of us, should be used as a decision locus by business decision makers in selecting any of these service providers to help them in their data protection journey.
Now, how can it, now suppose company XYZ comes to you for their data protection and backup recovery. How can they be guaranteed that the restoration process and what you give them back, like by the courier service, will provide 100% restoration of their information and data?
Testing is the most key element, to be sure, there. To do a full-scale simulation prior to a critical real-world disaster event and run through the process to make sure that it doesn't fall apart on any unexpected steps. The other is to keep your data policy up to date. As your business operations evolve and as new technical platforms enter your production realm, to change and update the data policy elements that describe your business operations and how they need to be recovered is making sure that those documents are living documents and don't drift from what needs to actually happen is the key. Then for the technical folks listening, there are other elements of validation that can take place, things like ensuring file checksums match and doing data integrity checks on a frequent basis and making sure that you have enough capacity available in your designated disaster recovery systems to be able to bring a whole new set of data back, budgeting for the correct amount of space to bring new data online and then begin computing that data, offering applications out to users, certainly matters a lot.
Okay. Now, as I mentioned, I wrote a pretty lengthy white paper about the BC planning for the C-suite. Now, one area that I, along with having the backup recovery procedures exactly spelled out, another big thing is communications. And this is more of a qualitative measure. But what's the responsibility of the IT staff in communicating with the key stakeholders, your customers, shareholders, third-party vendors?
Yeah. Well, the IT crew are most of the time the wardens of this data. They have core structural responsibility within the business to help ensure its health. And I would say that the responsibility of those individuals for communication is very significant. It's time for those staff members to break down, let's say, some historical siloing or some stereotypes around frustration or broken communication paths with the business at large. Explain in business comprehensible terms, direct and plain language, what is the relationship between a given system or application and what business operations depend on it. Do not attempt to hyper-focus on what are the technical systems. Look at everything through the lens of what are the business outcomes that depend on specific systems and make it known to those stakeholders what is the relationship between a certain, very summarized bullet point list of system names and the actual business outcome operations process the business cares about. Communicate what those details are. Participate jointly in the information gathering and discovery processes we've been emphasizing as part of policy construction, and then have ongoing feedback sessions, let's say maybe at least quarterly, with the business stakeholders that keep everyone up to date in refreshing that knowledge, either as new individuals come into the business and need to learn about it, or as the same set of individuals update their knowledge sets based on new platforms appearing in the business, new lines of business beginning to operate, all of those concepts. The communication responsibility is to stop using language that alienates anyone and start all participating in a common lexicon of what are the business outcomes and what knowledge sets can be connected so that everyone is operating on the same page. Because it isn't two separate teams at all. It's not two separate entities or anything. There is one company, there is one team, and they need to operate together on that common basis.
Okay, now, as we wrap up our show, here's the last question here. Now, there is a big disconnect in the cyber world, you know, physical security world as well, between the C-suite and the IT department and the IT security team. You know, I've written a number of blogs, you know, where, you know, I've kind of, you know, looked at some surveys conducted by some leading cybersecurity companies that have done, you know, major market research projects. And a lot of people in the IT departments and IT security teams feel that they're just not being heard properly by the C-suite, and even vice versa. In the C-suite, probably the CISO, the CIO, feel that the CEO and the board of directors doesn't really even listen to them. You know, and there's such a huge burnout right there. Now, how can these two hands, so, you know, the IT department, security team, and the C-suite, work together to make sure that the data is protected, not only for the good of their company, but for the good of their brand image, and finally their customers, most importantly?
Well, we've certainly saved nearly the best question for last, haven't we? This is the one for all the marbles. This is the one to really get into it. I don't know if I can manage to come up with some description that's eloquent enough to really shift old standing opinions or dysfunctional practices in the minds of listeners, you know, just here in one conversation. But whatever amount of change I can bring to people, I'd certainly like to give it a try. How I would describe the core challenge, the most important executional responsibility for business leaders in making those old negative dysfunctions go away, is to alter the core conception of what IT means to a company. The line of thinking that goes IT is a cost center or is a arcane, overcomplicated area of frustration that should just be minimized and dealt with only as much as necessary as to scrape by is not an acceptable line of thinking. Every company operating today has assets in digital form. They are core pieces of what drive your business operations and are part of how your business exists whatsoever in the world. Companies need to understand that the role of IT is a very important strategic one, that it is connected intimately to all of business operations and represents a force multiplier and a source of efficiency and a source of opportunity for how to go to market and get the business work done and generate maximum competitive advantage. Therefore, having communications that is based on mutual understanding and that is based on appropriate measured priority of what those critical company assets are that exist in digital form and how they need to be protected needs to take place as this open exchange of ideas. You know, come to the table together as equally responsible stakeholders who all care about getting to a place of success and who can communicate in a highly productive way if honesty is expressed and when everyone is given equal ability to share knowledge and value, to generate this synthesis of information out of all of the perspectives of all of those stakeholders, not to predetermine the place of certain stakeholders in IT as a lesser position or as something that only exists to be minimized and driven to the lowest possible cost. I think that is one of the most important distinctions between a highly functional, modern company and someone who is stuck in a dysfunctional place and cannot achieve these data protection goals and therefore will be continuously exposed to all of the significant and existential risks that we've been describing today.
Well, Jared, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. This has truly been a great honor and privilege. I think you're the first guest in podcast that we've actually talked about data, protection and recovery. And it's really been, I've learned so much from you in our conversation. Thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity, Robbie. Yeah, I really hope that talking about this and getting it to the right ears can make a difference out in the real world.
Once again, thank you. Have a great day.
Goodbye.